4, Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. ISIS says the shooters in California were supporters. The Islamic State terrorist group is describing the killers in the California massacre as supporters of the organization. The group made its first comments about the mass killing at a radio broadcast Saturday, but did not express direct involvement in the attack. Meanwhile, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation is stepping up its investigation into the massacre after determining the married couple responsible for the attack at a social services office did commit an act of terrorism. Authorities say Tashfeen Malik pledged allegiance to the Islamic State terrorist group on social media, but she has not been directly linked to IS. FBI Director James Comey says so far it has no evidence linking her husband, Syed Rizwan Farooq, to a terrorist group.
The investigation so far has developed indications of radicalization by the killers and of a potential inspiration by foreign terrorist organizations.
But investigators, he says, are still not sure if the couple acted on their own or on the instructions of an unknown group. Both were killed in a gun battle with police after fleeing in the rented vehicle. President Barack Obama said in his weekly address Saturday that despite the massacre, he said, we will uphold our values, a free and open society. We're strong, we're resilient, we will not be terrorized. The president also reiterated his call for stricter gun controls in the United States.
More broadly, this tragedy reminds us of our obligation to do everything in our power together to keep our communities safe.
The New York Times has published a front-page editorial calling for stricter gun control following a series of high-profile mass shootings that have rattled the nation. This is VOA News. British warplanes carried out a round of airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Syria late Friday, again hitting oil fields. British Defense Minister Michael Fallon said in a statement Saturday that two Typhoon fighter bombers joined the campaign for the first time, hitting an oil field in eastern Syria.
Last night, the RAF Typhoon aircraft, our newest aircraft that had only arrived from Britain the day before, were in action and successfully striking oil wellheads in eastern Syria. It is oil that underpins the terrorism that we've seen and helps ISIL-Daesh finance their terrorist operations.
British lawmakers approved the bombing of targets in Syria at the request of Prime Minister David Cameron. Three suicide bombers attacked a market in Chad Saturday, killing at least 27 people. Officials say the attack took place on an island along Lake Chad's western coast where a weekly market was going on. The borders of Nigeria, Cameroon, and Niger all touch the shores of Lake Chad. The attackers were not identified, but authorities did note the militant group Boko Haram has carried out recent bomb attacks in the area. 47 people died in two suicide bombings in mid-October, drawing condemnation from the United Nations Refugee Agency, since many people in the Lake Chad region are refugees. Chadian officials, who estimate 60,000 internally displaced people live near the Lake Chad Islands, had warned all residents to be cautious and said the government was beginning a military offensive against Boko Haram. The U.S. Space Agency has released a series of sharp images of Pluto, describing them as the best close-ups we might see of the planet for decades. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft photographed Pluto during its flyby in July and continues to transmit data stored on its digital recorders. The latest pictures, released Friday, clearly show a wide variety of cratered, mountainous, and glacial terrain, said a NASA statement. The images were captured with the telescopic long-range reconnaissance imager, called the LORI, aboard the piano-sized New Horizons about 15 minutes before the spacecraft's closest approach to Pluto from a range of about 17,000 kilometers. Mission scientists expect more snapshots from the most recent set over the next several days, showing even more terrain at this highest resolution. Authorities in Great Britain have closed roads, evacuated homes, and issued severe flood warnings as stormy weather hits the country. Weather forecaster in the Met Office issued its highest red rain warning for northwest England and southwest Scotland. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Simpoga. Peter Clote is off today.
Essentially, what's happening is that climate change is associated with an increasing injustice because of inequitable development in our world.
A UN official says agriculture must be part of the climate talks currently underway in Paris.
Dans ces pays, il n'y a jamais d'élection locale et municipale. Maintenant,
he says one reason for the timing is that DRC is due to hold local elections for the first time.
The Democratic Republic of Congo drafts a law that would impose tough penalties for persecution of ethnic group grounds.
At school and university, I had not developed any love for anti-corruption activism. And even though you went to prominent learning institutions, we weren't really exposed to such things.
And we look at the role of a young South African anti-corruption activist. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. And we start off in Paris, where officials attending a UN climate conference have approved a draft text of a climate deal. That draft document, after 4 years of negotiations, is meant to offer nations options to deal with the consequences of rampant emissions of climate-altering greenhouse gases. Critics say there are plenty of unresolved issues to be hammered out, including who should bear the burden of paying for new directives before an agreement can be reached by Friday when the conference ends. Scientists have warned that as Earth warms up, the planet will be increasingly hostile to human life with rising sea levels, devastating storms, and severe droughts. Meanwhile, irregular weather conditions such as frequent drought in Africa's Sahel region and extreme flooding in Myanmar are having an impact on food systems and affecting millions of people worldwide. For this reason, agriculture must be part of the climate talks currently underway in Paris. That's according to Dr. David Nabarro, the newly appointed special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the 2030 agenda. Dr. Nabarro has also served as a UN envoy on food security, and he is in Paris to push for making agriculture more climate compatible. UN Radio's Cristina Silvero spoke with him to find out more.
Climate compatibility needs to take account of ways in which agriculture can reduce carbon in the atmosphere through adoption of practices that lead to more climate compatible and climate mitigating behavior. I also want to see the adoption of practices that adapt to climate change in communities that are susceptible to changing climates, particularly those where people's livelihoods are being affected. For example, adoption of new varieties that are less susceptible to drought, also varieties that can cope with more saline in the water, and adoption of practices that reduce the extent to which people's livelihoods are affected by irregular weather patterns, particularly those that are associated with flooding.
Now, the term climate justice has come up again and again in the conference. Can you tell us what that means?
Essentially, what's happening is that climate change is associated with an increasing injustice because of inequitable development in our world. Poor people get poorer. Marginalized people become more marginalized. Disempowered people become more disempowered. The principles of the Agenda 2030 that was agreed by world leaders in September this year are that no one should be left behind and that those who are hardest to reach should be given first priority in all development work. Those principles become even more important when we look at how climate change is affecting the people in our world. So that's why we focus on the injustice provoked by climate change, the vulnerable become more vulnerable, and most importantly, women are the people who tend to be most disempowered in much of modern development, but they're also the people who are most affected by climate change. And that's why we talk about climate justice as being a particular outcome that we should be working on.
You mentioned Agenda 2030. Why is it so important to link climate change to development?
So, climate is a variable that is right at the center of all the efforts to think about the future of our world. In September this year, world leaders agreed to a new way of looking at development that links together 17 areas that are considered to be important. Of course, one of those is climate. The idea is that by dealing with all 17 areas and treating them as a universal objective for the whole world, we establish a fairer, a stronger, and a more robust approach to development. Now, we can't pursue that agenda without at the same time factoring in the impact of climate on people's well-being, an impact that's going to become more intense as the years go by. For me, representing the Secretary General on these issues, I see it as absolutely essential that the climate action agenda is brought into synchrony with the broader Agenda 2030 for Sustainable Development, including the provisions in the financing for development discussions that were agreed in Addis Ababa this year. Climate action and sustainable development are indivisible joint pillars of future work for the future, indeed, of the whole of humanity.
That was Dr. David Nabarro, the newly appointed special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the 2030 agenda. He spoke from Paris with UN Radio's Christine Silvero. Still in Paris, my colleague Kim Lewis is also in Paris to cover the climate conference. Hi, Kim. How is it going over there?
Yes, it's going really great, Douglas. I'm outside of Paris, actually, in a suburb of Paris, of maybe a little bit of an hour away, but things are going really well. I'm at the Climate Generations area where there are a lot of people here with inventions who are very active in the environment from all over the world. I spoke with someone this afternoon who is very interested in educating children in Africa. He is Mohamed Kamal, and he has an organization where he is helping schools to provide an education that takes into account two important things, and that is economic development of the African continent as well as the environment. And to really get young people, especially young kids, he says it's best to get them really young to become engaged and interested in their environment. Also at the same time, Douglas, he pointed out that, you know, children, it's important that they keep their culture, their history, even the traditions that their family have, but also they want to look forward in the future, and that is being focused on the environment, and that is through technology. Technology plays a big role in getting kids interested because, as you know, that's the way the world is moving towards it's high tech. So he's doing a lot of wonderful things, and he's been here. He will be here the rest of the week with his organization. And I look forward to speaking with many other people. I have a couple of people I will be speaking with tomorrow, and then more lined up for the rest of the week. Back to you, Douglas.
Did he tell you that he's getting a cooperation from the government where he operates?
Actually, he said that he is getting that cooperation. And it's just really important because you want to have the cooperation. And this is in the Republic of Congo. So it's just very, very important that these things have that partnership with the companies, the NGOs, as well as government.
Yes, we understand there's a draft agreement at the summit. Is he aware of the details of that draft agreement?
No, at this point, we didn't really talk about that. You know, one of the other things that he did talk about was the importance of farming as being an essential challenge for Africa as well as other countries. And so he's really talking about the desert and other ecosystems, and they have developed this really huge solar park. And he's claimed that is the biggest one in the world.
I see.
So that's in Africa.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much, Kim. We'll get back to you as the summit proceeds.
That was Kim Lewis in Paris.
A draft law introduced in the Democratic Republic of Congo's parliament will impose tough penalties for persecution on ethnic grounds. The bill has been through several committee stages but was held up by lawmakers this week. As Nick Long reports for VOA from Kinshasa.
The DRC's current law on ethnic discrimination dates back to the colonial era, and the penalties are relatively mild. Lawmaker Steve Mukai proposed a law in Parliament this week that would impose a 10-year jail term for expelling people from their province on ethnic grounds, or life if the persecution led to war or ethnic cleansing. He told the Assembly that regionalism, tribalism and clanism are stronger than they used to be in Congo and are corrupting the country's institutions and communities, causing mounting frustration and instability. In the 1990s, the country saw officially organized purges of Baluba and Batutsi people. Much of the conflict in the Kivu provinces is a legacy of that ethnic strife, stirred up by politicians. Mbikai first introduced this bill last year. He says one reason for the timing is that DRC is due to hold local elections for the first time, and these elections will likely fire up tribal feelings. Another reason, he said, is that the country was split into 26 provinces earlier this year, and some ethnic minorities in the new provinces fear discrimination. Several lawmakers objected to the bill in its current form on legal grounds. Our colleague Bikai was not well advised by the Assembly's legal expert, says this lawmaker, who added that it is not possible in Congolese law for a bill to modify several different texts, so the law needs redrafting. Lawmaker Juvenal Munubo from North Kivu province told VOA why he supports the bill. We have a lot of problems in our way of living together, he says, adding in Congo there are always tendencies towards tribalism among Congolese and relations with non-Congolese are worse. Bikai says he would present his bill again after redrafting it. In 2013, he proposed another bill, still at the committee stage, that would make homosexuality a criminal offence. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
A week-long international conference that focused on AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases in Africa has ended in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. As Sebastian Mhofa reports for VOA, delegates discussed a reported shortage of antiretroviral drugs to treat AIDS and a lack of government funding for healthcare across the continent.
Medical researchers, HIV activists, and health officials from across the continent met at the conference known as ICASA to look for ways to achieve an AIDS-free Africa. The United Nations says there have been dramatic strides in the fight against HIV/AIDS, and the World Body says ending the epidemic by 2030 is a realistic prospect. Zimbabwe's Health Minister David Parirenyatwa says immediate treatment for anyone diagnosed with HIV is one of the main steps towards that goal.
So the curtain has indeed come down on ICASA 2015, and it is time to move forward and to implement the resolutions that have been enunciated here. Test and treat, that has come out very strongly. So once you are tested for HIV and you are found to be positive, go straight for treatment. Are we going to afford it as Africa? This is where the international community comes in. This is where mobilization of resources comes in.
Earlier this week, medical aid group Doctors Without Borders released a report saying Africa is facing shortages of antiretroviral drugs, or ARVs. The shortages are likely to get worse with the new World Health Organization WHO guidelines. The guidelines remove all limits on eligibility for antiretroviral therapy among people with HIV. If one tests positive, should get treatment. The U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Deborah Bex was one of the delegates at the ICASA conference. She said the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, has released additional funding to some African countries to help them abide by the new guidelines. She said some countries were managing on their own without much funding.
We have been very encouraged. If you look over the last decade and you see what South Africa is doing to invest in the pandemic, when you look at what Namibia is doing to invest in the pandemic, when you look at what Botswana has always done. So there's countries on the continent that have the resources that are clearly applying those resources to control the epidemic in their countries. We think that more and more countries need to make that kind of investment.
African countries are signatories to the 2001 Abuja Declaration, which stipulates that 15% of each nation's budget should be allocated to health expenditures. But many countries have failed to live up to that pledge, including Zimbabwe, where most of the budget is spent on defense, civil servants, wages, and travels for senior government officials. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Three years of conflict has split the Central African Republic along religious lines, but a bakery in one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the capital, Muslims and Christians are working side by side. For VOA, Christine has more from Bangui.
After years of sectarian violence, it is uncommon to find Muslims and Christians working or living together in Bangui. But at Rahama Tir Abdullahi's bakery in the PK5 neighborhood, 15 Christian and Muslim bakers work every day to bring the city fresh bread. The owner, Abdullahi, is a Muslim, but he says as a Central African, he is not going to employ foreigners. There were Christians in need of jobs, he says, so that is who he hired. The trouble in the CAR began early in 2013, when the mostly Muslim Seleka rebel coalition overthrew the government. Militias rose up in December of that year and chased the Seleka from power. The pillaging devolved into intercommunal violence. Seleka's brief reign had been marked by abuses and pillage. Mostly Christian militia groups and mobs took revenge on Muslim civilians. Like many others, Abdullahi lost his home and shop. He fled to Chad, but returned. He is now among the few thousand Muslims still holding out in PK5. PK5 used to be a vibrant market area with five bakeries. Now only two are operating. Christian anti-Balaka militia besieged the neighborhood, waiting at the entrances with weapons. Coming to work is risky for employees like Fred Yokosa. Yokosa says if he were to run into the anti-Balaka militiamen on his way into PK5, they would beat him, stone him, or kill him. But Yokosa, a Christian, says he has no problem working alongside his Muslim boss. Yokosa says he is earning money and he trusts his boss, so why would he have any problems? But he acknowledges that as a Muslim, Abdullahi lives in danger. Even Yokosa has to hide in the bakery when fighting breaks out in PK5, as it sometimes does. Pope Francis recently visited PK5 and called for reconciliation between Muslims and Christians. The day after he left, a Muslim was killed just outside the neighborhood. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bangui.
South Africa's African National Congress, the ANC, has achieved notable success since it became the country's first democratically elected government after apartheid 21 years ago. A black middle class is rising and many more people now have water and electricity, but all is not well in democratic South Africa. There are frequent violent service delivery protests, the education and health sectors are in turmoil, and crime is high. Some South Africans are standing up against these crises and, in their small way, trying to make their country a better place. In this first part of a series of reports on a few of these unique individuals, we turn the spotlight on a young anti-corruption activist, as Darren Taylor reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
Thousands of people pour into the Pretoria city centre. They blow whistles and vuvuzela trumpets in a demonstration against the government. In the middle of the mass is a slight 23-year-old woman with long black hair. She wears a white T-shirt emblazoned with the words, "Unite Against Corruption."
At school and university, I had not developed any love for anti-corruption activism. And even though you went to prominent learning institutions, we weren't really exposed to such things.
But Kavisha Pillay's naivete about graft was shattered about a year ago when she joined Corruption Watch. The NGO probes what she considers to be the greatest blight on modern-day South Africa. Pillay, a journalism graduate, investigates corruption and manages the organization's digital communications platform.
So, in a nutshell, I'm trying to chase the bad guys and start an online revolution.
She's proud that she recently helped expose the actions of 10 corrupt school principals.
These principals are pocketing money for themselves. They are abusing their power where they are falsifying marks so they can get bigger grants from the government. They are using money that was meant for feeding schemes for themselves and then providing food of a lesser quality. It's a very sad situation when you see these kids that are going to schools where they could have huge opportunity and those opportunities are lost out of greed.
She says graft is infecting all sectors in South Africa, which was never the case until a few years ago.
We're living in a very sick society. In some cases, teachers are exchanging sexual favors for marks. We consider that as corruption. So if you are exposed to corruption at such a young age, when you grow up and when you develop, you're going to think that it is normal, and then this culture perpetuates. So,
like many in South Africa, Pillay blames President Jacob Zuma for helping create a culture of corruption.
You know, South Africa sometimes seems like that broken home with Zuma being that father who left, you know.
Zuma leads the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, party. Corruption scandals have plagued his presidency since he took power in 2009. For example, the government used almost $20 million of taxpayer money to renovate Zuma's private housing estate. South Africa's public protector has ordered him to pay back a significant part of this. Zuma refuses, insisting that several state-led investigations into his conduct have cleared him of corruption. But at a recent march to the president's Pretoria headquarters, which Pillay joined, speaker after speaker lambasted him.
"This building here is harboring the number one thief of South Africa."
Pillay accuses Zuma of poor leadership.
"If I was him and if my country mocked me on a daily basis and no one had respect for me, I would step down, you know, because clearly I'm not doing a good job."
Zuma insists he enjoys the support of the vast majority of South Africans. But Pillay says when citizens show open contempt of the president and his representatives, like they've done at several recent gatherings, it shows the tide is turning against graft in South Africa.
"The 10,000 people that have reported corruption to us is 10,000 heroes in this country. People are actually willing to do something about it. I mean, we see it with our whistleblowers who come forth. They are such passionate people. They want to see a change, you know." And
transforming her society for the better is what Pillay's all about. And she's leading the charge in the streets and from behind her computer. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the VOA, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. But before we go on, some breaking news on sports. The Ugandan national team, the Cranes, are this year's CECAFA champion after beating Rwanda 1-0 in the final in Addis Ababa. And now it's time for our Saturday Music Spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy some of Africa's greatest music. So here we go.
Somebody tomorrow, na so ibi ya. Choosy brother, where you kind of jealousy. You dey pop nose, you wanna see. If there is anything that you wanna see, complain, brother. No, they complain. As a super sharp, correct driver, you free to overtake. As a super sharp, correct rider, be free to overtake. No matter the gallop, you reach our destiny, and that's how we go. They go.
Africa lady, oh.
Aye,
see. I sing in the song for Panya.
Aye.
And I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya.
Anything, yeah.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya, eh.
Aye, what is my baby name? Panya, Panya, oh, Panya. Aye, what is your baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh,
Panya. Anything, yeah. For my baby girl. She's my fine baby, baby, oh, she's my African lady,
lady, oh,
Panya sweet like a chocolate. When she come around, she heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate. Baby, I am.
Aya, what is my baby name? Panya,
Panya, oh, Panya.
Aya, what is your baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh,
Panya. I request for my baby girl. Panya, Panya, they dance, shock you.
panya de dance, goro, panya de dance, nana o, eh o, panya. I sing it in song for panya, and I dance in the dance for panya, oh. For panya, nah.
So much love I have for you.
And I thank you the Lord for panya, eh.
Yeah.
village in poverty. So I'm using my sense to gather the properties. No time, like a statue of liberty. Nobody knows tomorrow, so I'll be holding my destiny. Yeah. I see the same I don't go. Some people they bop low. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. I see the same I don't go. Some people they bop low. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. Testimony, hey. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony, hey. I don't testimony, hey. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony, hey. I don't testimony, hey. Je m'appelle Chop Money. Hey. It's good to be saving for rainy days. Cause you know it's easy. Life is so delicate. Kuna see me as evidence. Baba God, now my confidence. Yes. His blessings are endless. So, hey. I see the same I don't go. Some people they bop low. Hey. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. Hey. I see the same I don't go. Some people they bop low. Hey. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. So. Testimony, hey. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony, hey. I don't testimony, hey. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony, hey. I don't testimony, hey. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, hey. Okay. Je m'appelle Chop Money. I see the same I don't go. Some people they bop low. I continue the struggle. The struggle they double my hustle. I see the same I don't go. Some people they bop low. I continue the struggle. They double my hustle. Yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony. I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. So. Testimony. Now I'm giving my testimony. Oh. I'm killing the beats, I'm giving them it. So. Now I'm giving them everything. Oh. I'm living my life, I don't chop money. I don't testimony. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't chop, I don't testimony. I don't testimony. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. I don't testimony. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. I don't testimony. Now my testimony, testimony, my testimony. I don't drop, I don't testimony. I don't testimony.
Like that.
Oh my God, that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to share with the Voice of America my examination of U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitude toward the United States. This week, two issues become very relevant in this discourse. One is U.S. policy and political violence in Africa and elsewhere in the world. Of course, the most important issue right now for the U.S. is the Middle East crisis and how political violence in the Middle East affects other parts of the Western nations. In recent times, much has been said about this. But when we look at how U.S. foreign policy is affected by developments in other parts of Africa, you come with issues like Boko Haram, which was very important before the Nigerian election. And the rule of Boko Haram in Nigerian politics is still relevant, and people are still talking about it. Even though many people thought the election of President Buhari would be a great breakthrough to solve that problem. The problem is still pressing, and I think Nigerians and people elsewhere in Africa are still thinking about it. The issue of political violence and its impact on foreign policy and in interreligious relations became very evident when the Pope went to Central Africa. During that journey, the violence between Muslims and Christians in that country occupied great attention. Hopefully, the religious leaders and the politicians from that part of the world will begin to learn from the speech of the Pope and, of course, the activities of many groups who are interested in bringing law and order in that part of the continent. But as we look around Africa and you look at U.S. policy around the continent, the question of development becomes paramount. And this is one of the reasons why U.S. foreign policy towards Africa is being looked at carefully and critically by other Africans in light of development in the continent coming from the hands of other nations. People who are looking at developments in different parts of the continent are trying to see how certain African decisions to negotiate with Brazilians, Russians, Indians or Chinese, or collectively the BRIC nations, and what they are doing in Africa. Many people will think about how the American government, during the time of Eisenhower, was beginning to affect African societies in terms of development, foreign assistance, and fellowships, and many other benefits coming to Africa. Now, the intervention of the Chinese in African society is beginning to create an order room for analysis of U.S.-Africa relations vis-a-vis Africa's relations with other nations. Recent developments in Ethiopia with regard to transportation is beginning to capture the attention of even American newspapers. The Washington Times, for example, reported on the developments in Ethiopia with regard to transportation in Addis Ababa. And this information, which was not known to many Americans maybe, or even interested in African issues, are beginning to see reflections of Chinese activities in Africa. The same thing was done in the early 60s when the United States government started to negotiate with Ghanaians, because Ghana was the leading country coming out of the continent dealing with Africa. At that particular time in history, if you look at it historically, the U.S. relations with Africa and what the U.S. was doing at that time in Africa and how the activities of America began to affect African opinions on and attitude toward the United States. So those of us on this side of the Atlantic who are covering issues or looking at how Africans feel, we have to go back to the basics. That's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. That was Dr. Nyang of Howard University.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of us, the Nightline team, we thank you for joining us tonight and hope to see you again tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Simpoga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns a terror attack on Tunisia's presidential guard that killed 12 and wounded 50 in Tunis. The Islamic State, or Daesh, has claimed responsibility for the suicide bombing, which was the latest in a string of terrorist attacks in Tunisia in the last year, including the Sousse Beach and Bardo Museum attacks, which left 59 dead. Terrorists have sought to use fear and violence to undermine the important gains the Tunisian people have made in pursuit of a democratic, stable, and prosperous country, said White House National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price in a statement. We will continue to provide robust security, economic, and governance support as they build upon the progress achieved since 2011. The people of the United States extend our deepest sympathies to the victims' families. Our government has offered assistance with the Tunisian authorities' investigation. Secretary Kerry was proud to stand with Tunisian leaders earlier in Tunis and reaffirm our country's extensive economic, governance, and security cooperation, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner. We will continue to support the Tunisian people as they work to build a democratic and prosperous future for their country. Tunisia is where the Arab Spring was born, said Secretary of State John Kerry. It is where it distinctly continues to bloom in ways that are defining possibilities for other countries in the region. The eyes of the world are on Tunisia, and America wants Tunisia to succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.